Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Brainstorm. This week, we're talking Terafab. What if I told you the entire global semiconductor industry isn't building fast enough, at least according to Elon Musk? Today, we're talking about what was announced, what's credible, and what's just a pure moonshot. Sam, Brett, help break it down for us.
Okay, I'll start at the very highest level there is. There's three ingredients for the future of civilization: solar panels, launch capacity, and semiconductors. The first two are taken care of. SpaceX is on its way with Starship to roughly $100 per kilogram to low Earth orbit, potentially below that launch capability. You have both Tesla and SpaceX ramping up solar manufacturing. And obviously, you know, China's already there, but in the US for US companies. And then this third ingredient is the missing ingredient, and that is where Terafab comes in. Brett?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. Basically, Elon always looks forward a few years at the choke point that he anticipates impinging upon his strategic plans. And access to chips is his anticipated choke point, because he believes that given, you know, a meaningful but not obscene impulse of capital, he can launch terawatts of energy into space, and just needs terawatts of chips to accompany that energy so that they can be used to train and infer, you know, massively intelligent AI models. And terawatts of chips are not available for purchase. And so he says, well, if you're not going to scale to meet my needs, I'll scale myself. And I would caveat it by saying that he's done this with batteries and the battery supply chain before. And as he began to commit capital to vertically integrating through batteries, that spurred the entire supply chain to ramp up in, you know, quasi competition with his efforts. And so it can also serve as a negotiating ploy to get these companies to throw more money at CapEx into the input that he needs in order to meet the strategic ambitions.
I like the framing here, but maybe just taking a step back, Brett, explain the semiconductor supply chain for those that might not fully understand what Terafab means to the supply chain.
I mean, my gosh, I'm not sure that I totally understand.
But the different components, because my understanding is that Terafab, it's one gigantic building that's three times the size of Grand or Central Park, and it's going to house all of the different, you know, supply chain components of creating semis.
Yeah,
like, the lithography versus
So one roof. Chip design, sure. Memory production, advanced packaging, and testing, all under one roof. Is that the idea?
Yes. The idea, I mean, as with all of Elon's ambitions, is to do vertical integration of all layers of the value chain so that kind of the person asking for the product can sit right next to the manufacturing equipment that's manufacturing the product and then get the output from the manufacturing equipment so they can instantly test and kind of iterate on that basis. Within semis, we're talking about massively hundreds of millions of dollars per machine pieces of capital equipment that are heavily intricate and complicated to build, maintain, and run. And his and so between growing the wafers, etching the wafers, producing chips off the back end, having test equipment in place to test it, it really, at least as laid out, is a plan that kind of exceeds probably anything in human history in terms of ambitions. I mean, the reported price tag is $20 billion. That's a lot of money to spend on a single facility.
And actually, like, relative to the numbers we throw out on our show sometimes, $20 to $25 billion actually seems low. And I know that's a crazy statement.
Yeah. Well, so to give you a sense of scale, Tesla's CapEx plan for this year is $20 billion. And some of that is devoted to the, what he calls an advanced fab for, that I think is kind of with Samsung in coordination to build their AI5 chip. So Tesla is already investing in some of this capital equipment, but this is a facility that it needs 10 gigawatts of power. And like within that context, it actually does seem like a low estimate for the amount of CapEx you need. Think about like 10 gigawatts to build 10 gigawatts of nuclear power is what, Sam? Like that's right there, $10 billion or probably right. quite a bit more.
I mean, depends if you're building it efficiently or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess the other way to think about it too is like yeah. $20 to $25 billion disrupts how many trillion dollars of market cap of all of the different companies that make up the semiconductor.
Well, no, it's not $20 billion. It's not $20 billion.
Just to get started.
It's $20 billion.
To put a shovel in the ground and start building.
To start it.
Yeah.
This is your starter set.
I mean, more than that, but that's like the kick-started capital. And I do think there's another piece out by Sam D'Amico, who's the founder of Impulse Labs, on it's like the knowledge that is in a factory versus in what a factory makes, which I think is quite relevant with respect to putting all of these in the same place to actually learn this capability and potentially why, you know, others trying to do this have not had the same degree of success. But we're veering really, I want to go back to Brett's point, which is this is not the first time Elon has done this. And it's like success has many paths here, right? So it's like at the highest level, it's those three ingredients. If Elon can do it all, that's amazing. And, you know, that's the plan that doesn't survive contact with the enemy, I would say. But it's like electric cars. Other people had done electric cars, but then Elon did it. And now it's like, is Tesla making the most electric cars of anyone in the world? No. But there's an electric car industry and the future's almost certainly electric. Same thing with electric trucks. It's like, was that a thing? No, in fact, everyone said it was impossible. And lo and behold, it's possible. And for
but
batteries,
this is not different, right? Unless I'm misunderstanding this. Like what he's proposing, outside of just bringing everything under one roof, the technology is not different, right? He's going to 2 nanometer.
No, that's the whole point. The scale is different. People were making robots for 20 years, and then Tesla decides, hey, we're going to vertically integrate and invest in this. And now you've got 600 humanoid robot companies whose funding has increased.
But when you say, scale, what do you mean by that? Because it's not like the rest of the semiconductor supply chain isn't also seeing the writing on the wall. Like if they could fulfill the demand, they would. It's just there's an issue with building these machines.
He
addresses this pretty head on, which is if you've been in the semiconductor world, you have tons of scar tissue because it's been a boom bust industry for a long time. He's saying right now,
he's writing a blank check.
He and many other people are wagering. They're wagering there's infinite demand for intelligence, which is the boat that I would say that we are in. And he is far more risk on than all of these people. And sure, it's like if you're in the semiconductor industry, you can say we're going to scale in a responsible way because this is what we think. We know that this might not happen. And so we're going to protect the business. And Elon is saying, you know, that's fun if you're trying to return, you know, 10% to shareholders on an annual basis. He's like, I'm trying here to get a mass driver on the moon and populate different galaxies. So it's a different game, different scale.
It's actually the rate of underlying growth, I think, is much more subject to kind of like people's will than is commonly understood. And so, like Sam says, it's like Taiwan Semi, you know, even to their investors, if you look at their investor calls, they're having to say, no, we think we have a strong confidence in kind of the demand coming from our partners, and we're calibrating based upon 2-year forward demand from these high credit customers like the AWSs of the world, or, you know, and so they are not wanting to overbuild capacity by accident, because like Sam says, cyclical industry, if you overbuild capacity, you know, essentially that kills your margins. And so suddenly you go from having a nice, healthy business to suddenly the business looks almost imperiled because you have a lot of capital in play and you're not utilizing your full capacity. And the difference this cycle, and these are dangerous words, like this time is different, but the difference this cycle is that, you know, we have demand you know, even in the knowledge space, leave aside embodied robotics and kind of everything happening in biology, in the knowledge space, we have a demand curve that looks like it extends not to infinity, but it just keeps building and building in a way that suggests that rather than saying we're going to increase capacity 20% per year, you can take real big cuts at your rate of growth and throw really big chunks of capital at it. And we think get good ROIC. So Elon is saying, these guys aren't moving fast enough for me. I'm going to take my own balance sheet and raise money to do it myself. And I am fairly certain that that'll actually cause the industry to counter respond, because if he begins to make progress, they'll look and be like, oh gosh, now we're going to be subscale to these guys. And they're going to have pressure from mega cap tech to build, to provide them competitive weapons to use against the Elon conglomerate, where Tesla, SpaceX, and XAI combined, not yet combined, but as like in, call it aligned entities, will have access to an increasing compute advantage relative to rest of industry. And rest of industry is going to agitate and say, you need to arm us to be on a competitive even playing field with this, you know, going to space behemoth. And so they'll send stronger demand signals to the supply chain, and the supply chain will begin to ramp up. Yeah. And then he'll, if he's like mis-executing slightly, he can flex into that kind of like neutrally available supply if need be. So I think that's kind of how.
What if it ends up hurting his positioning with Grok? If, you know, they're able to generate all of this, you know, new supply, well, the demand is going to Anthropic and OpenAI, not Grok. So, like, if they now become not constrained by compute, doesn't this, in a way, like, if what you're describing, Brett, where like he, you know, ignites the fire underneath the supply chain in the traditional semi market, they all get their act in order before he can scale up Terafab, then compute becomes widely available, and all of the demand that has been there waiting for Claude and ChatGPT is immediately unlocked. Lock-in value comes from an enterprise perspective.
I think that is.
And Grok is sitting there holding the bag with a huge balance sheet risk because they've taken on $10, $20, $30, $40 billion worth of debt.
That is a great problem to have that I don't think Elon is afraid of.
But
that
are we afraid of that competition?
Yeah.
Because we're not Elon. We're investors in Elon's companies. Like, it's like a meaningful risk that we should pay attention to.
I think there is an assumption that you can take compute resource and you can convert it into monetization potential. And Anthropic and OpenAI are, and Google, though we don't have as clean a look at what their revenue yield is off Gemini, but I'm sure, is executing on that set of actions. And Anthropic most successfully right now, the really crude math on AI model companies right now is one, first for data centers, take a gigawatt of data center, you can rent it to somebody for $10 billion a year. Okay. So like, and actually you can use that to crudely get how to how that space compute math will work, where you can kind of like loft the satellites into space and you sell the capacity to Anthropic or to Google for $10 billion and going up over time per year because it's harder and harder to build data centers on Earth. If you're an AI model company, you rent that $10 billion worth of data center and you run it through your model, and then you get to charge $30 billion per gigawatt for access to the tokens that you've yielded. That's the rough math right now. The data center, the cost of that data center rental is increasing around 6% per year on a forward basis, we think. The monetization rate for that compute compressed into a model is increasing around 20% per year. So it's a great trade. Like, if you can get that math to work. Now, that math is heavily, that is sensitized to how Anthropic and OpenAI are currently doing. It's not kind of like tuned to what XAI is right. currently doing, which we don't know. His wager is I can, one, kind of like point the XAI team towards the right target, give them enough compute, and they can also make that math work. I think over time on the enterprise side, there will be at least a few players, probably three or four, that are making that math work in some way. And they'll be in competition with each other, but it'll be a stable, pretty good margin structure, just like infrastructure as a services. On the consumer side, I think it's like we're really still in kind of the unexplored territory as to exactly how it's going to look. But that's the rough kind of math. And so then Elon saying, well, if I can get that math to work, I want as much compute as possible because I think that math continues to work no matter how many gigawatts I throw at the problem. And so, you know, getting a terawatt a year yields me, $30 billion, you know, times 1,000, $30 trillion in revenue potential per year, more or less, right? Now,
so
that's
$20 billion, just drop, we throw around big
numbers all the time. $20 billion seems like
Okay, Brett, one pushback here has been, okay, there's no timeline.
That's a curve.
Obviously there is some timeline in terms of incremental steps, but there's no timeline. Tesla auto sales are struggling, as are global auto sales. This is a good narrative for Tesla to raise capital into. Is Tesla going to raise capital alongside the SpaceX IPO?
This is all justification
for a merger. I hadn't considered that. Well, I don't know. I think that this clearly is a closer alignment between Tesla and SpaceX AI than has previously been at least talked about. So that's a first thing I'd put out there. They are, at least as presented, collaborating jointly on kind of this giant investment in this fab, with Tesla explicitly providing, the chips to its robots, to its cars, which are also robots, and to the satellites for SpaceX. It's still unclear who's going to do the solar manufacturing for SpaceX XAI. Tesla could. I think Tesla, contingent upon robotaxi cash flow beginning to come in and them getting like good market pricing of those expected robotaxi, cash flow dollars, could independently raise capital from SpaceX XAI, or there's a combination that occurs that serves as a capital raising vehicle. Clear that there's a lot of capital that's required across the entities to invest in this future.
And I think in his presentation, also good to note is that it is largely until Optimus truly scales, it's like the compute and the chips are going to space. It was like an 80-20 breakdown. So very much orbital.
But even when Optimus scales, the wattage required in the chips on Optimus are going to be much smaller than the wattage you're throwing into space. So his view is you'll have like on the order of Optimuses sold a year equal to humans divided by 5 or divided by 10. Basically, every human gets an Optimus and you replace it every 5 or 10 years, I think is how he's roughly doing it. So call it 1 billion Optimuses, but they're not on, the big chips that are going to go into the space module. So you still need most of it going into space.
As robotaxi, as a funding mechanism, Nick, you were sharing some interesting data points.
It works well. It works very well for my personal use. I think as a result of these conversations, our weekly conversations, I did end up trading my old Tesla Model Y in and getting the new version. And as a result, I got access to version 14 or the newest, latest, greatest FSD. And that is a noticeable difference between what I was using on my prior vehicle. So,
and what did you rank it out of 10?
Very recently. But that, this is classic when you're dealing with Elon, trying to understand, sometimes reality from what is thrown about. And it's like, I'm using it, it works. And then robotaxi is subscale and they're still behind Waymo. Or not.
Oh, you mean the robotaxi product in Texas,
well, when you look
at San Francisco. Yes. And it's like, give them some time, but also that is all potential energy right now. As in, Texas can produce, what is it, Sam, 500,000 vehicles, 500,000 Model Ys or something a year? Or hundreds of thousands. Until you cross this commercialization threshold, it's going to look subscale, and then suddenly it's going to be massively in excess of scale of Waymo. That's my view. I think it's pretty well founded. It's clear that kind of like going from, wow, this really works, wow, I'm using this, this really works, to, wow, this is kind of like set up in a way where it's dependable curbside drop off and pick up and kind of everything is stitched together, is still a pretty hard, hairy effort. And I think they're in process. I think FSD is, relative to every product, the biggest lifestyle difference between me and my like adult friends right now. They don't get it. Most of them don't have a Tesla. And of those that have a Tesla, even most of them don't use FSD. And I just don't understand them, one. Because I don't think that they have tried it in like over the course of a week in a real way, because they are driving their cars and my car is driving me. And it's my life is totally different from theirs on this particular vector. And it's like a true mass luxury product right now, even at its current capability level, and it keeps getting better. It's kind of bizarre.
It is. Well, you say that, and right, it took so long for Nick, who's
I was using was, I don't want to say putting me in dangerous scenarios.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like the product is
great. Like I could,
the product is in constant development.
Yeah.
It's the worst it will ever be until, right? So it's like people say they tried and they're like, oh, it's pretty good. And it's like, no, but have you tried it in the last month?
Yeah, in the last 2 months, really. It was, or 3 months. And there's a new 14.5. There's a new like point release about to come out, I think.
So back it'll be even to better. The issue at hand, the question at hand. The space component of the Terrafab announcement, mass driver on the moon, space, data centers in space. Can you help frame this? What is a mass driver? What is, you know, all of this mean long term?
Well, Sam?
The first, I think in terms of understanding what is going to happen, the timeline is Starship. Look at Starship first. Starship development is going to be the precursor to all of this. Once it becomes reusable, that's when you get the next order of magnitude drop in launch cost, where all of this really opens up. And so, you know, I think that's the most concrete thing for people to watch right now. And then you're going to see the deployment of a bunch of stuff, including Starlink, direct to cell, and orbital data centers. And then you're going to watch a combination of Starship plus Optimus capability, because in order to actually build this on the moon, sure, we could send up a ton of people, but even in the presentation, Elon notes it's likely Optimus and humans working side by side. And so I think you watch Optimus development from that side, and you'll be able to see pretty clearly the timeline trajectory that we are on. And then a mass driver on the moon, it's like you can essentially set up a railgun to launch satellites into space, as opposed to having to use propulsion like we do on Earth, because the gravity is a fraction of that on the Earth. And then from there, you can service both Earth orbit and beyond Earth.
So Sam, when you say that, you do recognize like the nested bets in everything that is happening, right? Like, because I think this is where people end up having an issue with Elon and his companies, is trying to like, you know, picture what he's describing. Well, like you have to be sure that Starship is going to scale and work. Then you have to be sure that Optimus is going to scale and work. Both extremely difficult challenges in their own right, but you need both of them to work around the same time to then get a mass driver on the moon, to then get data centers in space at scale. It's like all of this is just like
you're presenting it in a very deterministic binary.
That's the way you just described it, unless
Elon,
I'm mishearing.
No, of course it's a simplification, but this is, it's like the way you got to the Model 3 was not creating something perfect. And of course there were nested bets, and they've got the world's smartest, best, hardest working teams evolving through iterations here. And it's like, yes, if we are going to live on Mars and reach other planets, you need a lot of things to go right. But it's like, you're not getting anything. No one's getting anything right on the first try. But yeah, you need
the Starship becoming fully reusable is a major kind of engineering crossover threshold that they are directly targeting and betting on. And that opens up a lot of option value. And AI compute in space seems like the best exploitation of that option value. One, Starlink, you know, is a great cash flow generative business. The reason AI compute in space is actually marginally less IRR attractive, as far as we can tell, even as it scales. But the difference is it can continue scaling, whereas Starlink's kind of like demand elasticity curve tails off. And so you get the option value to throw a lot of capital into kind of the satellites that you loft. And so then it makes the value of that lifting vehicle much greater than it otherwise would be, because you can build 1,000 of them instead of 100 of them, and you can begin kind of driving down your turn times on them, and you can loft an obscene amount of stuff into space, which then, as long as kind of it continues to yield, which we think it will, then gives you further option value to be like, now we have cash to develop the moon, and then we're going to reduce our cost of servicing this Earth orbit constellation from, you know, $70, $60 per kilogram to down to like $5 to $6 per kilogram. And, you know, 2 years ago, Elon would have said, oh, the moon's a distraction, we're going to Mars. Right. And so he's not reticent to kind of like change the trajectory based upon his assessment of the strategic landscape. I think there's a lot of underlying logic for why moon development should and could happen. Like Sam said, it's like they do have to solve these first problems first. And there is an underlying very big bet that the demand for compute is really extreme. The demand for intelligent compute kind of like extends and extends and extends.
Yeah. All right. Were there any questions from last week's comments, Nick?
There's one question I thought was funny. Why does Nick look like he is perpetually surprised? Well, the answer is the show is not scripted. And some of the stuff that comes out of Brett's mouth perpetually surprises me. And some of the numbers and things we talk about, look, I'm constantly learning from both of you and the guests we have on the show. So I stay in a mode of, okay, the next thing that's going to happen is probably going to surprise me in our take and our analysis and our views about the world. I didn't see. There was another one question here. Maybe Brett, you can answer this. My sense of digital optimist was that it could drive, in quotations, your computer and run tasks and applications and complicated programs for you based on your prompts. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that's roughly right. And if the shift that is just now happening is going from agents that have like a very, call it managed access to your underlying systems, into a set of agents operating that can operate basically as a user interfacing with the digital interface of anything on the web and soon any application that runs on your system. And so this is hugely corrosive to existing software as a service companies. So imagine, I won't even name one, but imagine a performance management company that keeps track of your KPIs and you have to enter in your quarterly reviews there and stuff. They take that data and they have it like in an interface so any user can use it, but you can't programmatically access it because that's kind of like their secret sauce a little bit of they're delivering you the insights and the visualizations off of it. Say you want to migrate off of that platform or you want to do stuff that's custom. Well, you could ask their team to develop a feature. Maybe they'll get around to it, maybe not. Or you could just, as a user, go in and systematically pull all of your data back from that software as a service vendor. Well, Digital Optimist is what will enable that kind of behavior because their system won't know, is it the logged in user or is it just their Digital Optimist doing it? And so I think it's kind of like the next move in kind of agents operating in enterprises that then allows for backward compatibility with all of the thorny nested systems that people have already running. And I do think it'll be pretty dramatically disruptive to, you know, existing SaaS.
Awesome. I don't, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, see everyone next week. Please keep sending questions. We will answer them. All of them.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.